Your fever is high, and the pressure to log in at work is too. But when you finally decide to take care of you, there's Instacart. Just because that one perfect coworker is attending meetings, camera on, sneezing, coughing, and aching doesn't mean you have to. Trying to stay on top of things can get you further behind. Instead, use Instacart for tissues to teas, cough drops to soups, delivered in as fast as 30 minutes. Oh, and if anyone needs anything, send them to that one perfect coworker. Instacart. Delivery you can count on.
All right, here we go. Greg Scheinman with you. It is Midlife Mail podcast time once again. I am grateful for the opportunity to bring this show to you guys each and every week, and for all the support, all the feedback, and to all the guests who have graciously agreed to come on and share their time and share their stories with me and each and every one of you. It is a pleasure and a privilege to help men navigate middle age, achieve a better quality of life through the podcast, these conversations, and the newsletter that I put out each and every week. If you have not yet subscribed to the pod or the newsletter, you can go to gregscheinman.com, and you can do so right there. The podcast, anywhere podcasts are heard. And at my website, gregscheinman.com, you can subscribe to the newsletter, have it dropped in your inbox each and every Sunday morning. Essays on things that are occurring and going on in my life, focusing on the six F's, if you will, of family and fitness and finance and food and a little bit of fashion and a whole lot of fun, which will also include five things I'm into each week and a clip from the podcast and the show notes. So you get all that in the weekly Midlife Mail newsletter. So sign up. If you like what you're hearing, please tell everybody you can. That's how this thing grows. Share it, spread it around, help the Midlife Mail movement to continue to grow. That is what this is all about, helping one another, sharing and telling great stories, which leads me to my guest this week, Alfred Spellman of Raconteur Films. Raconteur, one who tells stories skillfully. Alfred is one of the most prolific documentary filmmakers out there with his partner Billy Corbin and David Sipkin. I have known Alfred, since the 90s, my time in Miami Beach, back in my independent film production days. And these guys were just starting out. But I knew even back then when I first met Alfred, again, and his partner Billy, that these guys had something special. They had a vision and they had a drive and a grit and determination to not only produce and direct and tell great stories, but to get them out there so that they are seen and that they are heard. Let's run down this list for a second because it's extremely impressive. Raconteur Films, Alfred Spellman, producer, joining me today, 537 Votes, new HBO, 2020 that was released, Screwball in 2019 on Netflix. If you haven't seen Screwball, you've got to check it out. Magic City Hustle, Dogfight, Limelight, Square Grouper, and the doc that put them on the map back in Sundance in 2001, Raw Deal. They have also been responsible for Cocaine Cowboys. You know it. That is a big one. Cocaine Cowboys 2, Cocaine Cowboys Reloaded, Confessions of a Cocaine Cowboy in 2019. Unbelievable franchise. And ESPN's 30 for 30. It's one of my favorite things is the ESPN 30 for 30 series. They did The U, Broke, Collision Course, and The U Part 2. Amazing. They've got new projects on the horizon, Savage in 2021, and more Cocaine Cowboys, Los Muchachos. Alfred is now 42, so it's been a good 20 some odd years since we have last spoken and caught up, but it's been awesome to witness his success and growth from afar, and we are going to talk about his journey, experiences, new ways of creating content, his relationship with his partner. Imagine being a partner with somebody that you met in grade school. You form a company with in high school, college, beyond. And here you guys are, married, kids. Alfred recently got engaged. He's heading down that path now too. That type of successful partnership and navigating business, personal relationships, life. Really great stuff. And Alfred is incredibly insightful, incredibly astute, has finger on the pulse of all things out there, pop culture to politics to sports. We could have talked for a very long time, and I cannot wait to have him back already now that we've reconnected. You can find him at racontour.com, RAKONTUR.com. I know you're going to want to check out more of their stuff after you've heard this conversation too. So let's get to it with Alfred Spellman on the Midlife Mail podcast. You know, there's this kind of digital media platform destination for guys, hopefully to have a place to go, listen to stories like this, listen to people, learn from it, glean what they want, take a little bit from maybe you, take a little bit from, you know, this other guy or whatever. Not have to be in a room raising our hand
and sure.
coached, but you know, just seeing consistent growth in the newsletter and consistent growth with listenership here. And I think the demo is vastly underserved.
Absolutely. 100%. And I just know it from, like, you know, the men's magazines that we used to read, you know, the GQs and the Esquires or the Men's Health or, like, you know, the monthly Bibles or the Details, maybe at one point or whatever. I'm just saying they were kind of like guardrails almost to living life, because they kind of showed you what different options were, different opportunities are. And now that we don't kind of all share kind of those, whether it's the same cable channels or it's the same magazines or the same set of facts, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, you know, it's like everyone's in their own rabbit hole. So it's nice to have a place like this where you kind of go and
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, and maybe you're seeing it too, is that the tide has shifted. From some of the, even the magazines and publications that you mentioned, where it used to be these like everybody, 20 something year old models on the cover and a certain look and everything else, to the utilization of like real people now, but also an older, more mature, a more sophisticated kind of cover guy. I mean, you look at the guys that are out there now, whether it's your Clooney's, your Laird Hamilton's, your Tim McGraw's, I mean, your Mark Wahlberg's, your Tom Brady's, these guys are all in their 40s and their 50s. And I think there's a metric for success that's not just about like what you look like with your shirt off, but what are you doing in business? What are you doing in life? What are you doing with your family? You know, like, what are you doing with all of these things? So people are looking to those guys because of the experience and the journey, as opposed to what am I going to get from that guy necessarily?
Right. What's also funny about everybody that you mentioned that they have in common is that they all came of age in a generation where there were mass market celebrities. Now we've got YouTube stars, and we've got, you know, political pundits on Twitter, or people on Twitch, or people on TikTok. And we don't even share kind of a commonality of celebrity anymore. You know, maybe in a movie star, you know, here or there, but not certainly in the way it was, you know, 15, 20 years ago when we were starting out in the media business.
It's so true. And I see that with my kids, at 17 and 14, their quote unquote celebrities are what you were just talking about. They're YouTubers. I mean, they're YouTubers, they're technology, you know, moguls.
Right.
They're the guys that are blowing up AMC and GameStop.
That's right.
Like, those are their celebrities way, the ones that they're following. And it's Snap, it's TikTok, it's Reddit, it's YouTube. It's not let's go to the movies or let's go to a concert and really follow that band or follow
that
actor or whoever it is. It's really, really kind of wild to see.
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't know if you, again, it's like, I feel like we're getting into, that might be good content for you, but I mean, it's the, you know, there's certainly been a democratization, right, of celebrity and how to monetize celebrity. You know, I don't think anybody gets as rich as they used to, you know, but more people can make a living. Newsletters and blog and, you know, and newsletters rather, Substack or, you know, podcasting or whatnot. So the opportunities to have your voice heard Even though there's so many more voices, there exists that niche, but nobody gets that uber famous anymore.
Yeah, and I'd love your take and your perspective on it again as a storyteller. And yeah, we're already in. Like I just we're just going because
he's throwing out
great stuff. But to that effect too, you know, everyone has a story. Everyone now has a platform in which they can tell it. The monetization of it and the metrics of it are very different, as you mentioned, than they were, you know, before. But you can make a living in a lot of different ways, you know, right now. And I do think, and I love your take on kind of the dichotomy between these moguls that are out there, these billionaires, the unicorns, the whales that people seem to kind of chase, your Musks, your Zuckerbergs, whatever. But then there's also like the same kind of person who blazes their own trail and is also really content living in Miami, making 20 grand a month on a newsletter from Substack and saying, I've never had a quote unquote job my whole life. Like, how does that affect you guys in the way you look at telling stories and putting content out there?
Absolutely. In fact, I mean, it's really our whole ethos. Yeah. And it reminds me of when we first met. You know, we met in, and I was just going back to look actually after you reached out to me, that I think we met in September of 99. You had moved down to Miami to run Gun for Hire. And we were, Billy and I, we were, I think 20 probably at the time. We were aspiring filmmakers. You were somebody who we looked up to because you had success already in the independent film business.
And yours became real.
First of all, I think what's important also to tell people, you know, the 90s indie film business, it's kind of hard to imagine it now because film got so, you know, nichified like all other media. But the 90s indie film boom was a place where everybody wanted to be. Artists wanted to make movies. People with wealthy connections wanted to produce, right? So you had kind of this amalgamation of, you know, people think 90s culture, New York City, you think, okay, Puffy and Jay-Z, Bad Boy and Rockefeller and hip hop coming of age. But indie film was its own thing during that era that so many people piled into. And, you know, I think probably the equivalent might be in the 10s, maybe like the EDM DJ boom. You know, where some you wanted to become a DJ, that was your art form. People became managers of DJs or promoters or whatever, and, you know, made fortunes that way. So what you had been doing, the two films you had produced, I think by that point, that was something that Billy and I looked at. It's like, wow, okay, here's a guy who's 4, 5, 6 years older than us, who's done it, and now he's here in Miami. And so, you know, what can we, you know, how can we kind of get our foot in the door of this business that you just read about at, Sundance, Harvey Weinstein picking up movies for $10 million and making Quentin Tarantino, or Robert Rodriguez, you know, household names. So that was kind of the industry that we wanted to kick down the door to. And what we didn't realize, again, it's one of these things where you only realize in hindsight, the two other things that happened that summer that we met were, number one, Blair Witch Project gets released in theaters. And so for the first time, you have a movie shot on video, not on film, get distributed in movie theaters worldwide and may, you know, gross $140 million. So it was the democratization of production. It was for the first kind of idea that digital video in high definition would supplant film technology at some point in the means of production. And the second thing that happened that summer was the proliferation of fast access of DSL, which enabled Napster, which when I remember getting my first DSL line that summer and seeing this big pipe and I could download the history of recorded music, I'm like, this is going to be illegal. I better get every single song I can before it ends. But we also said, well, if this is happening in music files, it's only a matter of time before it happens with movies. So two things that summer, the democratization of production with Blair Witch and the democratization of distribution with technology like Napster, was the harbinger of the next 20 years that we've just kind of watched unfold. And it all happened like that one summer that we first met and were trying to get involved in the nascent independent film industry.
Yeah, it was an amazing time and Miami was emerging. Like, and there was a shift in Miami between where kind of entertainment was coming from, you know,
right.
Hospitality, nightlife,
fashion,
a shift into, can we become a filmmaking hub? Whether that was short form music video, everybody had to have a music video shot.
That's
in Miami,
right.
You know?
That's right.
Whether it was international coming over to do some type of fashion, whether
That's
it was
right.
piece of a feature film that needed something, you know, down there.
But Latin music, Ricky Martin blew up that year. You know, I mean, you had kind of that trend into Latin music that really began during that period as well. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but
no, it was. I mean, it was really kind of like this cataclysmic, like whole thing was really happening, and everything that you said that you saw the nightlife guys that were going into hospitality and moving more into daytime and even nighttime. You know, there was a shift in we should be producing content above and beyond like the brand that we had built in a physical location about something. It was really kind of incestuous, and it was all feeding off of itself. What you guys did though, and have been able to do, first and foremost, I mean, you saw it like early on, like you saw, this is what we're going to tell stories. This is what we're going to do. The things that happened that validated, I think, what you had already seen, whether it was Blair Witch, did, I mean, you saw those things that were happening, but you and Billy had, like, you knew what you were going to do. Like, when did that kind of, like, so, thing, you know what I'm saying? Like, when you guys were, hey, we're going to tell stories, and it's like, you guys knew it in fucking high school, okay? And then, like,
we did.
The name of your company. Like, you know how insane it is to have a name of a company like at 20 and be like, it's never changed. Like,
so I tell people that our relationship, so Billy Corbin, my partner, and we are our third partner, David Sipkin, we all met, Billy and Dave met when they were 4 years old in preschool. They grew up in North Miami Beach. I met Billy in TV production class in ninth grade at Highland Oaks Middle School. And Billy had been a child actor. He grew up in South Florida, but would go out to LA for pilot season. He had done guest acting gigs on LA Law, Night Court. He was in the Steve Martin movie Parenthood. So he was kind of bouncing back and forth and decided that he wanted kind of a traditional high school life. And so he settled in Miami. And so that's when we met. And our TV production teacher, Miss Spicer, ninth grade, said, you two need to work together. And she put Billy and I together to produce the, you know, the morning news, basically, on the TV station at the school. And so that's where we started. We started making short films together. And so I tell people, I said, we've never had like real jobs. Like, we've been doing this since we were 15 years old. This is all we've ever done. I tell you, know, it's like the Rolling Stones. It's like Keith and Mick meeting on the train platform when they're 15 in Dartford or whatever. And, you know, and they've just been in the band ever since. We've just been in the band ever since. And luckily we've made it work. But to your point about Miami, there were a couple things that had also kind of cropped up around that time. First of all, Miami had been treated so well in fiction through the years, particularly films. The 90s, you had The Birdcage, The Specialist, Bad Boys. You had all these huge Hollywood productions coming to South Florida, and there was the talk of Hollywood East. Well, that's why you were here. We were going to build sound stages, and Miami was going to explode as this kind of film destination. We kind of felt, you know, ass backwards into making documentaries. It was nothing that we had ever even considered doing. We wanted to make narrative features and go to Sundance. I mean, that was like, you know, the dream is like a 90s teenager. So we kind of fell backwards into making docs. And what we realized was, in the same way that Miami had been treated so well and by Hollywood at that point, you also had Edna Buchanan, the Pulitzer Prize winning Miami Herald police crime reporter, Carl Hyacin, Dave Barry. So you had John D. McDonald in his Travis McGee series. So you had kind of these fictional characters and these reporters. But nobody was telling kind of the true wild stories of Miami. And we said to ourselves, well, you know, Spike Lee and Marty Scorsese make livings telling New York stories, and Barry Levinson tells Baltimore stories, and Robert Rodriguez is in Austin, you know. There's got to be room for somebody in Miami. We wanted to be the big fish in the small pond. We realized if we went to New York or LA, we're just two other schleppers out there, you know, rattling our cup to raise money. So to us, it was important to stay here because we had built our roots here. I was born and raised in Miami Beach. I'm a native of the island. I've never left. I've never lived more than 3 miles away from the hospital I was born in, Greg. So, you know, we just decided to stay and said, we'll give this a shot, being the big fish in the small pond. And we wanted the story that we want to tell after our Sundance doc was the story of growing up in 1980s Miami, with the thesis being that the drug industry built modern day Miami and transformed it from God's waiting room to America's Riviera. And so that was the thesis of the documentary that eventually became Cocaine Cowboys, which really kind of put us on the map and kind of kickstarted our career.
Yeah. I mean, Cocaine Cowboys, and now you're following that up with the sequels. But the very first one, And I want to get into partnerships and relationships. I mean, I was making some notes as you were talking. Like, there's so much here in 20 plus years, you know, of this. But I remember sitting on a couch. Okay, I think you gave me a videotape. Okay,
yes.
Sitting on my couch in Miami for what became Raw Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And this was literally like the public domain footage of a situation that became a Sundance winning, like, bidding war documentary that really, I mean, pre-Cocaine Cowboys, which put you on the big time map, it would say. But going to Sundance, as you mentioned earlier, back then, was like, that was as big as you get. Going to Sundance and then actually getting some accolades at Sundance.
It was winning the lottery.
End up on the cover of the New York Post. Tell us a little bit of the Raw Deal question of consent story.
So, boy, this is some story. So, in the summer of 1999, Billy, Dave, and I started hearing stories from friends of ours who went to the University of Florida. We're still in college now, right? So we are juniors in college. Billy and I are at the University of Miami. Dave is at Florida State University studying film. And we started hearing about the story about this exotic dancer who was hired to perform at a fraternity house who had claimed that she had been raped following the performance, and that the fraternity brothers had videotaped the alleged assault. She had gone to the university police department. The police department began an investigation. They went and recovered the videotape, and they determined that what was depicted on the videotape was consensual sex, not rape, and arrested the exotic dancer for filing a false police report. And the evidence of her false report was this videotape, which in Florida made that a public record. And so this created a huge controversy in Gainesville, in the fraternity community, the larger university community, among the National Organization for Women, because the videotape, you know, we all expect videotape to tell some sort of objective truth, whether it was the Rodney King beating tape or the 7-Eleven convenience store camera. Here, people watched what was depicted on this videotape, and reasonable people had totally different conclusions as to whether this was consensual sex or a sexual battery. And this is way before the Duke LaCrosse case. This is way before Me Too, obviously. This is 1999, 2000. And what fascinated us was this notion of, well, is there an objective truth? And this is probably the most murky example of whether something was a crime or not a crime, and one of the most controversial crimes that there are, or most disputed types of crimes that there are. So we set out to do the investigation that the police never did, and we got a hold of the videotape by making a public records request. And we were, this was Blair Witch had come out, so we were thinking to ourselves, you know, can we shoot something on digital video? What could we shoot? Documentaries up to that point were tremendously expensive to shoot on film because a film mag is only 11 minutes and then you got to go get a process. We had never even considered making documentaries. And at that point in time, even the word documentary was like, you know, you thought of the teacher rolling in the TV with the VHS and you had to watch some PBS, you know, some boring educational thing. You know, that's what the word documentary meant. So we said, well, you know, we're 21 years old. We said, we're going to take a leave of absence from the University of Miami. We said, this story is an amazing story. And we said, we need to go and make a documentary about this. And, you know, it was just one of those things. And it's happened to us a few other times in the 20 years since, where Billy and I, Dave will be sitting around and a story is just so good that we decide that we just have to do it. It just actually happened to us last week. You know, you discover a story, you start thinking about it, and it's like, you know, we're not going to worry about financing. We're going to go out, we're going to buy the camera, we're going to set up interviews, we're just going to go do it. And so this happened to us with Raw Deal. We said, we're going to take a leave of absence, we're going to move to Gainesville, and we're going to reinvestigate this case. And so we're shaking our cups all over town trying to raise money. And we had come to you first because you had, these indie film credentials from New York and you raised money successfully for films before. And so we said, well, let's go and see what we can do. And I remember your reaction because we had gotten the original Raw videotape and you watched it. And I forget who you were with when you were watching, but you're like, it was an insane videotape. And, you know, it scared some people off because it was raw. It was.
What was everything that you said it was? And what you guys did with it in telling the story was so incredible. But I do remember seeing it at the time going, okay, this is absolutely viable. Okay. There's really something here. I believe that these guys who are nuts, who are going to move the game, like they're really going to do something with this. And I remember those saying to Kate at the time, who was my girlfriend then.
Kate was your girlfriend then. That's right.
Nice, reserved, would have the opposite of me, everything else.
Right.
Saying to her, like, should I do this? Should I get involved? And it's like, no, like you can't do that. Like, it was a value system thing. There was like such an and where I want to go, this is obviously I should have done it. It would have been great to have done it. Okay.
But again,
20-something years later, we're married with kids back then, everything else. We don't agree on anything still, whether I should do something or not do anything. But has your decision-making process, has your risk-taking maybe thirst or like, fuck it, this is controversial, has that changed over the years as a 42-year-old, now engaged guy? I know I'm flip-flopping back and forth, but just love the part of the journey. Like, are we more sophisticated storytellers and we won't do shit now at Raconteur that we used to do? Or it's, no, we're going harder than we've ever gone before.
Well, it's interesting. So I think, you know, I think people who came of age, again, I was 20 in the year, or 21 in the year 2000, right? So, you know, I think that the people who came of age as adults in the first 20 years of the 21st century have had a series of experiences between 9/11, the Iraq War, watching Hurricane Katrina unfold, watching the financial collapse of 2008, 2009. I turned 30 that year. There's been a series of cascading events that have shaped the psyche, I think, of my generation in particular. And so when you ask, you know, I remember always being told that, you know, that you become more conservative as you grow up, certainly when you have kids, which I have not done yet, but hopefully will soon. You know, that kids make you more conservative, life makes you more conservative. And I think that in some ways, I've always been middle of the road politically, but I've become more liberal in a lot of ways. And so I think that your question of, you know, would we do the same things we would do then? Yes, we're still pissed off. We're still, you know, we're still kind of, you know, where corruption angers us, hypocrisy angers us. You know, our Twitter feed is full of kind of the corruption and shady goings on in Miami. So there are different targets now, I guess, is what I would say. You know, when we made Cocaine Cowboys, here's a great example. We made Cocaine Cowboys. We said, our approach to that was, we said, we're going to make a documentary the way that Marty Scorsese would treat the subject. We're going to make a gangster movie, right? Nobody treated drug documentaries up to that point in that way. It was always the white hats and the black, the good guys and the bad guys. The good guys are the cops and the bad guys are the drug dealers and traffickers and pilots and the people who enable this. And we said, we're going to switch that paradigm. We're going to not glorify, but we're going to tell the story of how this trafficking bonanza built modern day Miami, for better or worse, you know, but that's the truth. And so taking that approach, we, you know, got the barbs you would normally expect. It's like, well, you know, they didn't show you the tragedy or the downside of drug abuse and what, you know, the horrors that cocaine, and all of that is true. And that's just not the documentary, the story we were telling. So, you know, I would say that there are certain things that we would probably not do now that we did then. You know, I think probably Raw Deal, we would have made some different choices maybe in how we produced it or the storytelling. You know, same thing with Cocaine Cowboys maybe. But I think that our storytelling now is just as provocative, but just about, just kind of with a slightly more mature perspective maybe.
Mm-hmm. You talked about famous partnerships like Mick and Keith for a second, and obviously, and you and Billy and David. How do you approach the partnership? How do you keep reapproaching, you know, the partnership? Is it like you guys play a concert and get off stage and Mick goes on one bus and Keith goes on another bus? And we're just like, or like, is the band like still super, super together? Like every day?
Yeah. I mean, well, look, I mean, obviously the pandemic has changed this. You know, I've seen Billy once, twice in the past year since last March. And, you know, and both of those were for shoots for a project we were finishing up for HBO that premiered last October called 537 Votes. But that's, you know, I haven't seen him since. That's the longest I haven't seen Billy probably since we met in 1992. So, you know, Dave I see every day because Dave still comes into the office and I go into the office too. But Billy's home with wife and his 4-year-old. So, you know, he's got more of a suburban life now, but it'll be interesting to see what happens when things snap back. You know, I would say, you know, as you get older, you spend less late nights out, Craig, as I'm sure you can, attest to as well. You become a bit more fond of the mornings than the late nights. And so, you know, things definitely change, but we're still in the office every day. We still get pissed off and call each other at midnight about this story that just hit the Miami Herald. Can't you believe this? And so there's still a lot of the same spark to the storytelling, because essentially, you know, that's what we love to do. We love to tell stories. We love to be able to go out, find fascinating characters and fascinating stories, and then go tell the world about it. And then we still have a great hunger for that. So, you know, maybe some of the dynamics have changed, but in terms of the types of stories that we want to tell and the things that we want to say, I think you can kind of draw a straight line from Raw Deal all the way through, you know, our work that's going to come out this year and next in terms of the types of stories.
Do you have a particular process that you go through, like even every day, like what are you reading to find these stories? Like, what are you looking for? Do you go outside of even Miami and go, well, I wonder if something like that happened here, because we really focus on Miami stories, but I read this thing that happened in Texas, but I bet it happened here too.
Totally. Well, like, for example, we did the documentary Limelight about Peter Gation's New York nightclub empire that collapsed under the Giuliani transformation of New York City.
Night there. Yes.
Yeah. Well, right. We are certainly not limited to Miami. We don't limit ourselves in that way. We look for stories that we think we could lend something to expositionally. And I'll give you a perfect example. We made a documentary two years ago called Screwball, which was about Alex Rodriguez and the Biogenesis steroid scandal. And one of the things that we do in terms of our process, which I think probably differentiates ourselves from other nonfiction filmmakers, is we always look for what the narrative genre analog is, right? So in other words, documentaries can be comedies, they can be thrillers, they can be romance, they could be musicals. Documentaries can be everything that a narrative film is. So to call the genre documentary does a disservice to it. So with Screwball, we said, well, this story is an outrageous heist story, right? This is like a Coen Brothers movie come to life. These characters, it's basically about how a fake doctor and his fake tanning addicted patient steals his records from him over a $4,000 loan that went bad in the back of a tanning salon. But these characters were straight out of a Coen Brothers movie. And so we said, well, we're going to steer into that curve. So, you know, earlier that year, Icarus had come out about the doping scandal, won the Academy Award, a very serious story. This was our comedic heist Coen Brothers take on it. And we ended up needing to shoot recreations. And so we cast all 8- and 9-year-old child actors to play the roles. And so that was kind of
his A-Rod is stuck so great.
Yeah. So that was our approach. So when you say, you know, what is our approach to storytelling? One is if we can bring something to the story in a creative way, in an entertaining way, and also stories that, you know, aren't just a segment on 60 Minutes. You know, why should this be an hour and a half or 2 hours? Or why should I make a mini series out of it? Is this just something better done in a 15-minute or 20-minute segment on Dateline or 60 Minutes? So those are kind of the two questions we ask ourselves, you know, when selecting a project. But to your question directly about process, you know, what we love about making documentaries and why we've kind of stayed in this realm and avoided traditional Hollywood, even though we did a deal with Michael Bay and Jerry Bruckheimer to adapt Cocaine Cowboys into a television series, and it spent 8 years in development hell at HBO. And we said, you know, if we had to depend upon that to pay our rent, we'd be out on the streets a long time ago. With a documentary, we're interested in the subject. We pick up our cameras, we set up interviews, we go shoot them. We own our equipment, we go shoot interviews, we come back, we edit them. So it allowed, we don't have to wait for actors and agents and managers and finance. We can go begin work basically. So that's kind of the what we love most about kind of the niche that we've carved for ourselves. So in terms of process, it just allows us to be very quick and to get started on stuff we believe in.
Yeah. And again, on the foresight of it all, what's kind of ironic now is that, you know, the way you guys view documentaries and the way you do it, in a way, and the freedom is almost like the way that anybody can do content, you know, these days, that has become like, if your content is good, you know, people will find it ideally and watch it. You know, what you guys have done so well is find these incredible stories and do such quality work with it. But I think to your point, it's like you pick up a camera and in a way go do it, pick up whatever and go do it. So you were just way out ahead of that curve, you know?
But you asked a good question. I'm sorry. I just want to follow up on something you asked because I realize I have a better story to tell, which is you had asked just, you know, about our creative choice and our creative process. After we had made Raw Deal and certainly Cocaine Cowboys in 2006, the entertainment industry was in the full throes of the reality television boom. You know, certainly Real World started in the 90s, but the year Raw Deal came out in 2001, Survivor premiered. Then there was Big Brother and Temptation Island and The Real Housewives. And so 2006, 2007, there were a lot of people trying to get us into the reality television business. You guys make documentaries. It's a short hop over here. There's a ton of money in it. You make these shows and then you format them and then you make 150 episodes and you can. And I remember Billy Dave and I sitting down and looking at it. We entertained some ideas or some concepts and we said, you know, we don't watch that. We don't watch reality television. I don't really know what makes one show good versus one show bad. To me, it was all kind of wallpaper, you know, television wallpaper. And it didn't interest us. And it wasn't something that we would want to watch. And, you know, probably kind of pigheadedly, we said, yeah, we're not going to do that. We're going to stay in our lane making premium documentaries, which was not the way to go if you wanted to cash in. And what happened was, and we stayed in that lane for a while, and it was still a struggle for a while after Cocaine Cowboys because making feature documentaries was not a real business for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And we started to get some commissions. Thankfully, ESPN launched 30 for 30 in the midst of the Great Recession, which we always call the full employment program for documentary filmmakers. Thank God to the ESPN folks because they put all of us to work in 08, 09, 10, and 11. But then something peculiar happened, and that was The Jinx hit on HBO and Making a Murderer hit on Netflix. And all of a sudden, multi-part premium documentaries were a thing. And now, because of Netflix and because of Amazon and Hulu, there were more avenues than ever to distribute premium documentary content. And what the entertainment industry eventually realized was that there was a huge pent-up demand for premium nonfiction storytelling that was never being addressed at the marketplace because the marketplace was dictated by 10 or 12 channels maybe at the time or four or five acquisitions executives. But there was a huge demand for premium nonfiction and true crime storytelling. So Netflix, with its unlimited shelf space, exposed that basically. Blockbuster, there's only so many slots for VHS or DVD tapes you have. But on Netflix, you have unlimited shelf space. So when people were finally allowed or offered a plethora of options and the marketplace was allowed to dictate what was popular, what the popular content was, what the content that we're going to be talking about, you know, at the water cooler, the fact that Tiger King became the biggest doc miniseries during the pandemic. Before that, the fact that we had two Fyre Festival documentaries, I mean, that were both hugely successful and talked about on the internet nonstop. And, you know, the kind of the Schadenfreude of the Fyre Fest became like a big pop cultural moment for a few months. So, you know, I think that what in our business, what's unfolded over the past 5 or 6 years has been fascinating. The pendulum has swung back in our direction towards premium documentaries. And I think it's going to stay there because people like to watch nonfiction. And finally, the marketplace has woken up to it.
Mm-hmm. It's a really great point. And obviously you mentioned, you know, money, saying, okay, we were offered these opportunities to maybe get outside of our lane. And I can only imagine what agents, managers, everybody was throwing at you guys. And you have to process all of this coming out of those big highs. And now all of a sudden, and you only get maybe one bite of the apple. And if you can't, and you can't say no to this person or that person or whatever. I mean, and you had to just display such kind of foresight and maturity at the time. And almost sometimes like an ignorance is bliss. It's like, you know what? Hey, we want to do this. We want to do this. Right. The dumbest thing in the world, but here's where we're going. What is your relationship, you know, with money? Has it changed? Like as an artist again, you know, as somebody in their 20s and now somebody in their 40s, you go out and shoot it. Don't think about the money. we do a project where we want this to be funded first, or right. Hey, I want to eat at Joe's. Okay. Right. Fried chicken is great for $7. Yep. You know, I'd like to order the stone crabs now also for 15. Like, how has your relationship with money and in this business changed?
Yeah. So I'll tell you, I'll go back to kind of looking at it through the perspective of being, of coming of age as an adult in the first 20 years of the 21st century. You know, if I had kind of followed the traditional life pattern that most of my friends who had gone into traditional industries had done, by 2008, by the year that I turned 30, my friends were married. Some of them were married. Some of them were having their first kids. And I opened up a nightclub lounge with a buddy of mine in 2008 called the Bella Rose. And we had that for a year and a half. And that year and a half, I think, stunted my forward progress a little bit. Not, maybe not stunted my forward progress, but at least kind of had me in neutral. Because it was the question of, well, what's going to really happen after this? You know, the thing that happened with the Great Recession, in our how it affected our business, is that the DVD market completely collapsed, right? So Cocaine Cowboys had come out in January of 2007, and we sold a ton of DVDs of that documentary. We knew we would. We knew that this is going to hit on DVD really big. And we were one of, I think the buyer at Best Buy told Magnolia, our distributor, this is the only documentary where we have increased our order quantity quarter after quarter after quarter because more and more people are picking up on this. And then 2008 hit, the Great Recession basically puts the entire world in neutral. Distributors go out of business, Circuit City goes out of business. All the music stores, the specs, all the places where you used to buy physical DVDs.
Down Team Baby, my other company.
That's right. Oh, and what from G? Well, that's right. That's right. And so, that had it. And for us, we had just kind of kicked down the door to the indie film industry with Cocaine Cowboys for the first time, having a successful distributed movie. And now all of a sudden, whoop, the record stops. And it felt like, you know, it's like, well, now the paradigm's going to shift. But what is it going to shift into? And we had made a couple documentaries following that. We did the U for ESPN's 30 for 30 series in 2009. That was a commission. So basically, they paid us for it. We made it. And that was that. We had two other docs that premiered in 2011. One was Limelight. One was a documentary called Square Grouper, which premiered at South by Southwest, which was kind of a pot smuggling era of South Florida, the Jimmy Buffett era of South Florida before the Cocaine Cowboys came in. And both those documentaries really struggled to find an audience because there were no more DVDs, but there was no streaming yet. So we were kind of in that period of 2 or 3 years before, you know, there was kind of like a business model for us to continue. So, you know, again, when you talk about kind of personal growth, 2008, 2009, 2010 was kind of a period where we were like, well, are we going to stay in this business? What is this going to look like? What is going to be the model for us to be able to continue? And so the normal life decisions like buying a house or getting married or having kids just seemed like the thing to do was, hey, we're going to live in the moment. We're going to enjoy this period. We're just going to ride it out and see what happens. And in many ways, it struck me as kind of similar to the people who were New Yorkers who lived in New York following 9/11. Because in those months after 9/11, we didn't know if there was going to be another attack every week. It seemed like there was inevitably going to be another attack. It was unbelievable that there wasn't at the time. So I think that, you know, people who lived through that era in New York City kind of had the same, maybe not fatalistic, but certainly kind of that, you know, things are kind of in neutral for the moment till we kind of get grounded and figure out what's happened. So that was a real formative event in the way that my relationship to money, my relationship to kind of personal growth, I think. And that got stunted for a few years by the Great Recession. So I think that now, as I'm going to be somebody older, getting married, having kids, probably it's given me a lot more sense of what can happen, and knowing that you have to have that safety net, you have to have that reserve, you have to have that nest egg. That, you know, don't go pile all your money into a liquid, investments. You know, don't go open businesses that you're not necessarily, totally familiar with and comfortable with. And don't chase the fad. You know, don't go out and make NFTs now or whatever. You know, don't go and chase Bitcoin. You know, don't go and try to make that JPEG and sell it at Christie's for $67 million. Slow and steady wins the race.
Well, again, as somebody who's grown up in Miami Beach, You know, you've seen enough to know enough, you know, at this point. And I think it's kind of that rite of passage in a way where you have a little success, you have a little something. Let's go open up a little bottle.
That's right.
Kind of the rite of passage. What's interesting also is coming out whole the other side, you know, coming out with your head still screwed on straight and saying, okay, like, yeah, I bought the yellow Porsche. I turned 40 or whatever. But like, and then like, okay, I got to get rid of that fucking thing. Like the bar, the nightclub, the whatever, like been there in a way, done it. And we're seeing, by the way, so many of those entrepreneurs, those operators that were in that industry. What's interesting now is flipping it towards like health and wellness as they've gotten older. And we talked about like Sunset Harbor, which was nothing. Mm-hmm. 30 years ago when I lived down there and Gun for Hire was, and you go down there and it's, you know, anatomy, it's gym, yep, it's juice bars.
That's right.
Most of them were run by guys who were running like Lincoln Road.
Nightclubs, right. That's right. Like, that's right.
Bars and nightclubs all day and night.
Well, I'm fascinated to see what happens when, you know, now that the pandemic is, it seems like finally, thank God, coming to an end. And I think things are going to snap back. I'm one of those people who subscribe to the fact that we are going to see an economic boom this fall. And I think it's going to be driven around experiences and travel and consumption. And, you know, I think of all like the touring rock, you know, musicians who haven't been on the road in a year, who have to get back on the road immediately as soon as they can. I think we're going to have concerts every single night of the week this fall, winter, and spring, because everybody's going to be back on the road and everybody's going to be out again. But the question is, and for me, and again, I don't know how other people have lived during the pandemic, but I've become very healthy. The last cocktail I had was in March 10th of last year at the Edition West Hollywood before I flew home, and the world shut down. You know, I've got the booze cart in the house, but I haven't touched it. I haven't been interested. You know, I'm a social drinker, but you know, being at home this whole time, I just haven't been interested. And now that I feel better, I'm 162 pounds. I weigh what I weighed when I graduated from high school. I knocked the 12 pounds that the 12 extra pounds I've been carrying, I knocked off in COVID. And so, you know, now I just wonder, like, I'm not going back to drinking and going out, you know, till 2 in the morning, you know, the way that I might have. You know, I'll have a drink or two, but but my habits have switched. And I'm curious to see what happens with everybody else. And I mean, what that means for nightlife and.
Yeah, I think, I think both things are accurate. I think people have had an opportunity right now to reclaim their health, to change their buying habits, to change their eating habits, to change their drinking habits. And a lot of people have taken advantage of that in a very positive way. I know we've tried, certainly in our family, to do that. We've gone from going out every Friday and Saturday night, if you will, even mm-hmm. if it was just to dinners, we weren't going out later, sure, but spending a bunch of money, but even still going out and doing it. And you never inevitably, you know, order the drink when you're there or whatever.
Of course.
Shopping at farmers markets on Saturday morning and eating at home and investing in a bigger table, you know, because
right.
So, you know, you're getting healthier. But I also think there is this absolute pent up, like, I miss concerts. You know, I deal with that. I miss experiences, certain things. There have been some benefits to traveling now with a resort that's 20% occupied versus
100%.
And there's some, but I think you're absolutely right with that. And that there's a large percentage of the population that is chomping at the bit to get back out there to consume. And it's, I love that you mentioned that word in, you know, consume and consumption, because one of the notes I had that I wanted to ask you about is the other word, producer. Like, you've been a producer your whole life. There are producers and there are consumers in there. You've been producing your entire life. And the kind of enthusiasm and passion that still exudes from you when you talk about story ideas and content and everything that's there. You mentioned the side project with like Bella Rose, but like, do you want to produce anything else? You know, I mean, like, you're capable of producing anything. I believe if you can produce a film, if you can finance, fund, source an idea, put these fucking projects together from idea to execution, you can produce anything. Have you thought about like producing anything else? Or is it still, I want to just tell stories?
Well, I tell people all the time here in Miami, because so much of our industry here is driven by real estate developers, that movie producing, because, you know, you get asked, what do you do? And I say everything that needs to be done. That's the answer of what a movie producer does. You know, if the equipment needs to get carried to set, there's the intern doesn't show up and I got to carry it up from the hotel, then I do it. And that's what, you know, a producer does. It does everything. And so, you know, I talk to real estate developer friends of mine. And I say, what you do is the same as what I do. You got your subcontractors, you get your materials and your labor, and you have to, you know, you have to keep an eye out on the big picture. So producing definitely lends itself to all sorts of the skill sets that you need to produce, lends itself to all sorts of other businesses and industries. And, you know, we've thought about it. We've thought about, you know, doing other things. You know, there is a part of me that got bit by the bug when we did when we had our lounge nightclub, that one of the things that we don't really have is kind of a retail one-to-one presence, right? We'll do film festivals. You'll go meet and, you know, do Q&As after. But, you know, typically we're selling to wholesalers, or we're selling to Netflix, or we're selling to HBO. And so our relationship with the fans or with our audience comes via Twitter, via social media mostly. So we've given some thought to doing some more experiential things. And, you know, I think this year we're going to do a big 20th anniversary week for Raconteur with a screening series, and maybe some, you know, maybe a museum exhibition, you know, some things like that, to try to do some live events. But, you know, we love telling stories. You know, it reminds me of, there's the late New York Times columnist, David Carr, had a great quote. You know, if you're lucky enough to have this job where you get to leave the building every day and get away from the computer and go meet people more interesting than you, and go and be able to get their stories and come back and be able to tell people about these incredible stories that you find, he's like, that should be a hard job to get into. You know, that shouldn't be easy. That should be something that you need to have just an incredible amount of passion to do to be able to get to the next level. And so, you know, it's that storytelling bug that keeps us, you know, kind of anchored where we are. You know, we'll do a dramatic project. We'll do a narrative feature at some point. We'll do a television series at some point. I'm certain of that. But in terms of other industries, it's just, it would take so much time away from kind of our core competency. You know, one of the things that I'm really passionate about, that both Billy and I are very passionate about, is the problem of the collapse of local news, local journalism. Across the country. You know, thank God the New York Times and the Washington Post picked up the slack during this era to really do some fantastic journalism. But the Miami Herald's a shell of itself. All of our local newspapers are collapsing across the country. So I think if we were to ever kind of do something adjacent to what we would do, that would be something we'd be really interested in, is trying to crack that local news conundrum. You know, how do you create a profitable local, you know, sustainable local news business? Because I think certainly there's no city in America that needs a watchdog, a strong local journalist organization more than Miami does, with the amount of corruption and just nonsense that goes on here. So that's something that I think would kind of, but again, that's storytelling too. So, you know, you kind of got me, Greg.
You mentioned connecting with your audience, social media, Twitter, Instagram, whatever formats it's on. And you're pretty vocal. You know, there you interact pretty darn well. You know, sometimes.
Oh, thank you.
You say what you want. You know.
Yes.
I'm going with this, and you guys have also covered some seriously controversial topics that involve some pretty heavy hitters, good, mm-hmm. good, bad, and indifferent.
Sure.
Have you ever been scared based on anything you've said or content you've put out, or gotten like some weird phone call? It's like, hey, I mean, you deal with some pretty interesting topics.
Yes. And I tell people all the time that if that did bother us, then we couldn't do what we do. So, you know, we like to say that, you know, look, Twitter is Twitter, right? Twitter is the WWE. You know, Twitter is not real life. Okay. And I really wish that, I think that a lot of journalists, a lot of people in the media forget that sometimes, that, you know, that things that are said on Twitter or the way that conversations occur in social media are not real life, and so need to be kind of treated in that form, right? Like for decades, we had talk radio functioned in that way for a long time. You know, so I think that there are different kind of boundaries involving social media. But in terms of our documentary storytelling, you know, we've never been told that we've treated somebody unfairly. You know, nobody's ever complained to us about their depiction, that what we did was unfair. You know, there have been people maybe who don't like the way that they're depicted, but never have we been told that, you know, that you really, that was a hatchet job, or you buried me in that. That's not how we do, you know, what we do in our professional capacity is separate from what we do on social media. And so I think a lot of times people do get that confused or you know, might not fully kind of grasp that. But, you know, I think that's a distinction that we try to make a lot. And people who know us from our social media personas, I think, are oftentimes surprised to find out what charming young mensches we really are.
So A-Rod could just wink when he sees you. Gives you a little wink, like, okay, yeah, when he sees you, you got, okay, I get that kid, you know.
It's, you know, again, it's all true. You know, we all have our, you know, it's like you're the highest paid baseball player of all time. You know, you've made $500 million playing professional baseball. These are the facts. They're what they are. He's doing just fine. I see his Instagram. He's doing all right. No.
Is this what you thought it was going to be? Also, like, you know, now you're so into it. I mean, and has that changed, I guess, too?
Yeah, that's a good question. Boy, is it what I thought? Again, because this has changed, the business has changed on us almost every 4 or 5 years in the 20 years we've been doing this. Yet, you know, we started out when we first met, the audience that we cared about were the 6 or 7 acquisition execs that worked for Miramax or Lionsgate or HBO or Artisan or IFC or whomever, because those were the gatekeepers to decide whether or not the story we want to tell ever got seen by an audience. Then we caught the DVD boom and we started selling DVDs, and that was great. Then, you know, the economy collapsed and we went to commissions where we worked for channels and ESPN and VH1. We did, you know, these premium docs for them. And now it's, you know, kind of back to the streamers, and social media has kind of dominated the way that we begin to tell and approach storytelling. So it's almost changed every 3, 4, 5 years. And, you know, so it certainly keeps you on your toes. You know, there was a period of time I remember where we had desperately, this is probably right around the time we were doing Raw Deal, 2000, 2001, where we wanted to break into the music video game, because as you point out, so many music videos were being shot in Miami. Well, it's like, we're here, we know these locations and everything. But Napster happened and the music business collapsed. So just as we were trying to break into music videos, budgets are slashed, labels are shuttering. And so that disappeared. Then we thought, oh, the 30-second spot is where you go. That's where you make money. All these guys, Michael Bay and all these big directors make huge money. But then, you know, ratings crashed and, you know, the television landscape fragmented. And all of a sudden, 30-second spots were kind of, you know, awarded to really kind of the people who were just in that business. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, you know, is it what I thought it would be? It's changed so frequently and so much that it always feels like we're dealing with something new. There's a new partner. There's a new distributor. There's a new outlet. There's a new method. There's a new technology. Our business has just evolved so much over the years that it keeps me on my toes.
And at a time also when so many men are second guessing, you know, or questioning their profession, their life choices in there. And you're just doubling down. Like, I mean, it's refreshingly candid and great. You almost wish like everybody found what they were passionate about and were able to stay in it. Yes, the industry can change. And yes, the outlets can change. And yes, you know, maybe we get, you know, kind of plugged in and tight in the hip hop world because they love Cocaine Cowboys and we should think about music videos because all these guys want us to do it, you know, or the sports world and every athlete now is into us because they saw Broke and they saw the U. And they're like, I mean, and you guys could again navigate, you know, through all that, but you know, the commitment to the actual business itself, you know, or the ethos as you talked about just telling good stories, to not have that change again, at this age and stage, when you see so much of that, I think that's just a great point to make, or something to point out to guys. Like, if you love what you do, you like the industry, just do it better. Like in there, you know, it's not always about quitting and moving on to the next thing. Maybe it is if you fucking hate what you're doing, you know,
like, sure, really, sure.
And that's part of the stage too. But if you really love what you're doing, and the fundamentals of the industry itself has changed, like, figure out how to change with it so you can keep doing what you're doing.
Well, and that's a great point too. And I'll use this comparison because, you know, after the kind of we were pushed, or, you know, people were looking at us into reality TV, you know, the next question everyone asks, well, how are you guys going to scale? How are you going to scale your business, right? And I tell people, I said, the difference between us and say, the real world producers or people who produce reality, those are factory operations and we make things by hand, Okay. We are usually five or six people full time. We are a boutique operation. Billy so far has directed all of the projects we produced. We are slowly now bringing on other directors for projects that we are just going to produce. But at the same time, it's really difficult to scale because of the way that the approach that we take and the care that we take in the storytelling. And I'll give you an example. You know, I look at somebody like Shane Smith with Vice, right? Vice was a brand that when we were starting out, I looked up to in these years. We were making Cocaine Cowboys. Shane was selling those Vice Guide to Travel DVDs in American Apparel stores, right? And like, we looked at his brand with the magazine and those DVDs, with him going to the, you know, the weapons market in Pakistan or wherever he went, you know, and he was the voice, the authentic voice of that brand. He was the face of that brand. He was the voice and ethos. And what happened with Vice is, as they tried to scale up and launch their own cable channel and do all these things, you have to hire a lot of people and you have to train them in your voice. And sometimes you can't train people who you're paying $30,000 a year to, or $40,000 just starting out, you know, to be that voice. And all of a sudden the brand gets a little diluted and it loses some of its authenticity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could cash out and you could convince Rupert Murdoch and you convince Bob Iger that you have the voice of the millennials and that, you know, you're the one who's the millennial whisperer and you could sell out, make a ton of money with your company. But what's Vice now? You know, and this was a youth brand that I loved and I loved their work. And it just feels like it got diluted and it got to the point where, you know, it was a great exit opportunity, but what's it now? You know, and then on the other hand, you have the Pennebakers, and you have Frederick Wiseman is 92 years old, just released a new documentary a couple weeks ago the New York Times is writing about. So you can be in this business forever and you can tell the stories that you want and make good money and earn a living and, you know, and hopefully have an exit event or take on an investor or be able to cash out or sell a library. But when you're going to go sell to News Corp or you're going to go sell to Disney and you're going to go from a handmade operation to a factory, you're going to lose something in the translation. And so for us, we've decided to stay a boutique operation because we make a pretty good living and we have a lot of fun. And I'm still wearing shorts and t-shirts to the office at 42 years old. So
I love the analogy though, because it's so perfect and so easy to comprehend, you know, between kind of the factory versus handmade, you know, and the quality aspect of that. And you're going to have differences. And I'm sure you guys at one point have tried and brought somebody on for whatever number a year, yeah. You know, I can't never put out what you wrote, you know, or like right. it's so difficult to get people to write in your voice or get people to do things in a manner.
Sure.
Even again, doing them a certain way. I'm sure it's possible. I've never for one had the patience.
When we talk about hiring, we always say there's two ways of doing it, right? You could hire the person who's experienced, who know how it's done, right? Or you could hire the young kid out of school and you teach them how we do it because we made it up as we went along. There's no rule book for this. We have our own way of doing things. And so a lot of times we find when we bring somebody on who's done it the right way or done it, you know, whatever, it doesn't mesh kind of the same way that you need to kind of mold the, you know, you need to take kids out of school and mold them.
Totally. It makes perfect sense. So we're going to go here now. Okay. So 42, engaged now.
Okay. Yes.
You mentioned Billy, married, suburban kids out there.
Yes.
How does a personal relationship get brought into, you know, your professional life? And then how do those two things work together as they get, you know, more serious? You've got a partner now that since high school. Mm-hmm. Now he's suburban, he's married, he's living with kids, and you've seen him twice in the last year. You're going to be a married man yourself.
Yep.
Do you like check with each other like before, like this is getting serious, or you better like her, or you know, beforehand, or like
my joke that I've told girls that I've dated in the past is that my longest relationship in life has been with Billy and Dave. That's my longest personal relationship. So, you know, it's look, luckily I'm in a situation where, you know, I found somebody who's very tolerant of the eccentricities of running the type of business that we run and the type of occupation or really, avocation that we've taken up here. So it's been tricky to kind of just find that right, that right balance. You know, she is 10 years younger than me, which is It seems like a lot of time, but culturally it hasn't been, because I've kind of, by virtue of having been single as long as I have, I've kind of stayed maybe younger than most, musical taste, you know, certain things that happen that you know, when you get married, or certain events happen where you get like frozen in time. I had read an article once that you stop listening to new music in your early 30s. That generally by your early 30s, you don't pay attention to popular music anymore, that what you've grown up with, that's kind of what you listen to. And I found that not to really be true in my case. Now, I try to stay very in touch with pop culture. And being in Miami, you know, one of the things that you have the opportunity to do, because so many of my friends are in the nightlife and hospitality business, that I'm out a lot, or was before COVID. So, you know, I see, you know, it sound like a grizzle. I see what the kids are listening to in the clubs now, and I don't like it, but I know what it is. And, you know, so, you know, I watched like the EDM boom. You know, I watched DJs getting paid $200,000-$300,000 a night to perform at Live, you know, like a gold rush happening, you know, in this, you know, and I'm like, what is going on here? What is this? But you have to stay in touch with what people are into. And so and particularly in our business, and for the type of stories we like to tell, because they generally do appeal to kind of a younger male, more, you know, urban demographic. When I say urban, I don't mean ethnically, I just mean cosmopolitan, big city mm-hmm. type demographic. So, you know, you have to kind of stay in touch with what's going on. And so it's difficult. It is a balancing act, but at 42, I try to stay young and try to, you know, pay attention to what the kids are wearing, what they're watching, what they're doing, and, you know, try to stay up on things.
Well, it's also, I think, a particularly interesting, you know, dichotomy, I've used the word already, between how quickly you guys came up and experienced success early, and how mature you had to get in it to be able to handle that, you know, and not squander these opportunities. And you did that really, really well. And then you have this middle that you talked about, you know, this 20 year period of now we really have to, this is a business. We run this like a business. We're still telling stories, but you know, you're not on the cover of the Post every day, you know, like
that's
the shit thrown at you. And then here again, in your 40s, like, it's like you grew up and got mature and got quote unquote old fast, but you've gotten like now like younger because you've like been through it. And now it's like, I'm young, I'm energetic, I've dropped the weight. Like I feel kind of runs in that. Nobody can see my hand moving right now. You know, that kind of arc there.
But which wouldn't have been possible though, had we been married, had kids earlier, because that sets you on a very rigid life. That's it. You know, the time you wake up, the time you come home from work, the amount of time that you spend family versus doing work. You know, there are days where Billy and Dave will work till 3, 4, 5 in the morning editing because they like working overnights because the phone doesn't ring and the Twitter doesn't go off. And so you could just kind of focus on what you do. But, you know, working till 4, 5, 6 in the morning isn't so good for the family sometimes. And you got to see the kids, or you got to make breakfast, or you got to pick them up from T-ball, or whatever the case is. So there's a lot of things that by virtue of us having delayed the kind of typical life path have allowed us to kind of grow the business. And I think, to your good point, kind of almost stay younger on the other side of it, because we haven't had to kind of have those stresses of those life balances earlier on.
Those kinds of compromises, you know, at the time, or be stuck kind of in that situation where I have these choices or decisions to make and something's going to suffer, you know.
Sure. Or do things for money. Maybe we would have gotten into the reality television business if we had a wife and kids early on that we had to pay, as opposed to toughing it out for a few years during the Great Recession, making docs, doing fine, but not making that reality TV money that, you know, might have been a lot more attractive had we had some obligations at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it opens up a whole another can of worms. We can go down that rabbit hole about, you know, living without regret and decisions that are made, you know, in the forks in the road, and in a whole nother story you could probably tell all there about, you know, these choices that can be made and how every action has its reaction, and the path that you guys were able to take, all three of you.
Let me give you the down. I don't want to call it the downside, but let me give you the flip side of the story. What I don't have are those life-defining moments that divide your life into chapters, right? My life is divided into chapters. If I were to tell you about the last 20 years of my life, the chapters for me are the movies we've made and when we've released them, right? That's how I would define it. You would define it by the birth of getting married, right? Moving, starting a company, selling a company. You have different. So in a way, at 42, I look back on my life in Miami Beach, my entire, again, having never moved off the beach, living on this island, where it's, though career-wise, it's been, there have been peaks and not too many valleys, luckily, more peaks, but there haven't been kind of those dividing lines.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say that, because when you look at it's like a timeline. When I was kind of prepping for this, going, okay, and thinking about reconnecting with you, you go to the website, and what's the first thing you see? Okay, it's a timeline. What's Alfred been doing?
Right.
Well, he did it in 99, 2000,
right.
2000.
That's right.
Like literally, there's a date next to every title, and you go, basically, this guy's done a film a year, every year for 20 years.
Right.
Okay,
that's right.
Here's the space in between. And this one did really well because now there's a second one.
Right.
But it's literally like a timeline. And what you're talking about there is kind of interspersing in that timeline for a lot of people. Like if my timeline, you're going to put a bunch of other lines in there for other things that you said. And it's a really great point about the sacrifices that people make personally and professionally to try to accomplish their goals or stay on path or follow their passions. And then at what stages and times do they transition? And not that you can maybe say, okay, well, this is the year I'm going to fall in love, or whatever.
Right.
But
you
do start looking and start thinking at certain times, just like, we should probably think about kids right about now. Or we should probably start to think about this being a little bit more serious because I'm open to it, now.
Right. Right. And I would say that happened to me, mid 30s, and you look back on the timeline, I could define I could define it by personal, by dating and relationship girlfriends I've had or whatever relationships that I've had over that period of time. But, you do get to a point in your mid 30s. And what's funny, of course, is that, you see your friends who, as my mother used to joke with me to justify my extended bachelorhood, was, you missed your first divorce. And it was funny because you would see girls that you dated in your 20s who got married, who get divorced, and all of a sudden, maybe you get a call again when the divorce goes through, And so you see, it comes full circle sometimes for people. I've had friends, who I've been to their second weddings already, So, you do kind of see that as it transpires for other people. And the way that I always looked at it was, my friends who were happily married were further along, but my friends who were unhappily married were way behind me. I was kind of at zero, where I was still kind of in the place where it could go either way. But if you were unhappy, and the people who are unhappily married with children were the worst. I mean, like you'd look at people in that position, or I'd look at friends in that, or people I knew in that position. I'd be like, geez, that's a real, it's like, I think I have a problem because, I didn't get a call back from that, interview subject I wanted or whatever. It's like, but I don't have to wake up in an unhappy personal situation with the freight of having brought children into the world as well and having to deal with all of this. I mean, that always struck me as kind of a terrible bargain in your 30s and makes you get old much quicker.
I would agree with that. Fortunately, not there. Knowing people in that situation, just how difficult and how challenging that has to be. I can't remember what I was reading the other day with the list on it of things that can make you happier, be grateful for, or whatever the criteria is that somebody put into five fucking bullet points that I'm supposed to listen to, and they're going to be good for your life. But one of them was like, don't have children with the wrong person. I'm like, very hard. Okay. For you in life, that does make things challenging. So not the spot we're certainly going to end on. You are Mr. Miami. You've been forever. So what is your top, I need a few top places from the insider, in Miami. Where is you're drinking coffee. Where is the best coffee in Miami right now?
The only coffee to drink in Miami is at a Ventanita, which is a Cuban coffee walk-up window. You will find them scattered throughout Little Havana, throughout Miami Beach. It is essentially a snack bar style window that is an appendage to many Cuban restaurants. You could look at Versailles or La Carreta, and it is essentially the social hub in every neighborhood. You go up, you order a colada, which is basically Cuban coffee, rocket fuel that is served in a little styrofoam cup. And you sit at the window and you pour little shots of it and you hand it out and you talk politics, you talk sports, you talk the weather. That is the place to go get coffee in Miami at any Cuban Ventanito walk-up window. That's the place to do it. Invariably, you'll see kind of a big, you'll always see the big orange jug of water, like, you know, that's on the back of a construction truck. They'd have the jug of water there, and you go and you order your cafecito. So the only thing I recommend is cafecitos in Miami. It doesn't really matter where. Practically any Cuban restaurant will make you good ones.
Bingo. Okay. Where do we eat? What's your favorite place now?
I mean, you can't go wrong with Joe's. I mean, Joe's is the beginning and the end of Miami Beach. It's the oldest restaurant in Miami Beach. I'm pretty sure they are still either the top one or two. They're always kind of ranked at one, two, or three in the top grossing independent restaurants in the country. I think Tao Vegas, Noah and Jason, they always get, I think number one or two. But Joe's is always right up there. And Joe's is only open 6 months a year. And they still manage to be in that list. So everything begins and ends with Joe's. If you are going for late night cheap eats in Miami Beach, La Sandwicherie is still the best French sandwich walk-up window, Greg. I know you probably remember Sandwicherie from your time down here. So that's kind of highbrow and lowbrow. The best view for eating is still Smith & Wolinski down in Government Cut, the tip of Miami Beach. The big, tough reservation to get in town right now is Carbone. The major food group guys came down from New York in the middle of the pandemic and opened Carbone down south of Fifth as well. So those are probably the three big ones at the moment, or the two big ones at the moment in Miami Beach would be Joe's for classic eats and Carbone for your tough reservation to get.
What should we see that most tourists don't come down there and see?
You know, one of the things that people don't think about, Miami is the only metropolitan area in the country that is bordered by two national parks. We have Everglades National Park to our west and Biscayne National Park to our east. And Greg, I think, when you were down here, didn't we take you out to Stiltsville? Did we go out to Key Biscayne?
The houses on the stilts, yes.
That's right.
We're going to go,
I remember that.
We're going to be either washed away or torn
down. Right.
There was a story.
We were looking.
Wanted to do something on Stiltsville.
Right.
In my notes now, and because I still am infatuated. Now, I used to Google like bigger homes, bigger home,
right.
Fancier car, more, more, more. Now all
right.
I do is look for less, less, less. Like
that's
tiny
right.
homes.
Tiny homes, that's
like,
right.
I can buy some land and put the tiniest thing it has.
That's right.
And I always remembered Stiltsville because of that. Like, it reminded me of Belize almost.
So it's a cluster of houses built on stilts in the shallows of Biscayne Bay that were built in the 40s and 50s as kind of like weekend retreats / gambling and booze halls. And, they kind of have a sordid bit of history. And over the years, hurricanes have decimated them. Hurricane Andrew wiped out a bunch. I think we just had a fire burn one down the other day. There's six left. And they are deeded to the Biscayne National Park now. So they're just kind of out there as you go out of Key Biscayne. If you go out of Crandon Park Marina, you'll see them in the bay. But to answer your question, people think you come to Miami, you're coming here for the nightlife and the women and the parties and this, and all of that is true and all of that is great. But the natural beauty of Miami is something that I think a lot of people don't take advantage of. And the fact that we are situated between two national parks, and Everglades is, it's not... it's not Banff. It's not, Grand Teton. It doesn't have these great, majestic mountains. It's a swamp, but it has its own natural beauty and mystique to it. And so I encourage everybody to get out into Biscayne Bay and get out into the Everglades and check out our park system in Dade County. It's, I think, one of the best in the country.
Alfred, thank you so much. This has been awesome. I could do this for like two hours. We're going to do
this. Great, Greg.
I'm buying you breakfast in Miami in a couple
Fair
of
enough.
Weeks to catch up on so much more. Where can people find you?
Raconteur.com, which is spelled RAKONTUR.com. We use the phonetic spelling. We named our company Raconteur, one who tells stories with skill. So find me at Raconteur.com or Twitter, Alfred Spelman.
Awesome. Guys, check out all of their films, from Screwball to Cocaine Cowboys to Square Grouper. I mean, they're all amazing. And you can find them pretty much everywhere now. Netflix, Amazon, I mean, Prime.
iTunes.
Like,
There you go.
Wherever documentaries can be found, okay, you need to check out what these guys are doing. Alfred Spellman, Raconteur Films, on the Midlife Mail podcast this week. Hang with me for 1 minute. Guys, if you like what you hear, please give us that 5-star rating. Leave us a nice review. Tell your friends, your family, everybody you know. Share this stuff. That is the point of this whole thing. Subscribe to the pod. Keep the Midlife Mail movement growing. You can find me at gregscheinman.com. Subscribe to the newsletter. Every Sunday, you'll get it dropped in your inbox as well. 5 things I'm into. Audiogram, show notes from the pod, my thoughts on a bunch of stuff, and you'll have it each and every week. Thank you so much. Until next time, we're out.